I love you, people.
Welcome. This episode is brought to you by Rand Paul. Rand Paul, who says stupid shit just enough to let you know he's alive. Hey everyone, this podcast is brought to you by the Alabama Take, a culture website that brings you such joyful endeavors as this podcast to other shows like This Song Sucks, and writings and musings on all sorts of topics. And you know what? We're open to new ideas, new writers, new podcast hosts, you name it. If you have an idea and you wanted to pitch it or just be a part of the Alabama Take's family of shows and writers, just email me at thealabamatake@gmail.com. I'll get back with you and I will help as much as I can. I promise that. You know, we're interested in having new shows. There's a possibility coming. I wouldn't mind us a nice little show on politics or whatever you have in mind. As for this podcast, we're about television, movies, and music. I'm the host. I'm the editor-in-chief. I'm Blaine Duncan. Today, on the agenda, two big things. We've got the new album from Big Thief we teased last week, and the sixth episode of Euphoria. We're always a week behind on that show because of our recording date. You guys may have watched the seventh episode of Euphoria at this point. Just a programming note, we will be off next week. There will be no podcast episode on Tuesday, March 1st. No podcast from us. After that, we'll be coming at you every Tuesday, with the exception of one other planned break I know of on the horizon. But, you know, I'm pretty sure we'll keep a regular Tuesday schedule. Our breaks are few and far between. We enjoy ourselves, and so we try to get together every week and talk and let you in on it. As for today, we're going strong. I got my guys here, got my folks joining me. Usual suspects, Adam Morrow, Donovan Reinwald, they're here.
Great to be here, Blaine.
It's a real honor.
Yeah. That's so you kind of hit some ASMR peaks there with that one. That was very pleasing.
He tends to. He tends to. I want to start with something before I forget it. I saw a classic moment you only see in movies and television last night. My wife.
Was it someone getting hit in the pee-pee?
Close.
Such a classic.
We're catching up on The Righteous Gemstones last night. We're watching the most recent episode, whatever it was. And there's a moment in that show, and she took a big sip of water. And literally, this is not a joke. This part is not a joke. They say a joke on The Righteous Gemstone, or they do a funny bit. And she spits the water all over the floor to the point where we had to pause it and go get a towel.
Spit take.
Yeah. She says, I don't know why I took a big drink of water before this show or even during this show. It's real stupid. And funny enough, if you've watched The Righteous Gemstone, a little bit of a spoiler, their cold open involved pretty much the whole family puking. And she was eating, so we had to pause during that so she could finish eating.
Yeah.
So.
That makes me think of the Euphoria puke scene that happened this season. Oh, that was another brutal puking, if you will. And I'm just immature enough that I was kind of hoping that everybody else would start puking. It would just be a chain reaction of disgust.
That's what happened on the Gemstones.
Okay. So there is somewhere that will satiate my 13-year-old desire to just watch people vom everywhere. Okay. Yeah.
Boy, I've got good news for you about last week's episode of Somebody Somewhere, too.
That's right.
If you're looking for vom,
that is so right. Yeah, last week's episode of Somebody Somewhere had a moment. That's right, where it was triggered by another. Yep. I mentioned at the top, and I'll tease it here just a little. We're working on a few things behind the scenes. What are some podcasts you'd like to see in the Alabama Take family? I personally would be eager to hear a politics podcast from us, because we may surprise a lot of people who have this conception of what Alabama people believe and think. I'm not sure how many people listen to us outside of Alabama, but it might surprise people if one of our crew developed a politics podcast. But what's another one?
Is sports too obvious?
No. And then that might be one we can get. We might be trying our best to see if we can get some folks developing. Yeah.
I think that could be really fun.
I do too, yeah. I'm eager to see if we can't get something off the ground with a few of our people.
What about a podcast where white guys talk about podcasts they should start?
That's it. That's this one.
No, I think the politics one. I would be super interested in that. I remember thinking there's a Walmart neighborhood market just down the street that we'll go to for our essential groceries. And I always think, you know, if either party really wanted to figure things out, they would just build a platform that appeals to 90% of people who walk into the store and try to understand these people. And I think Alabama is a severely misunderstood place, both on what you're talking about of like the old classic bright blue dot in a red state. Like, I think there's, you know, that element of like sticking out like a sore thumb. But there's also people misunderstand what makes Republicans here tick. Like, I don't think that there's that much othering to...
So
there's a way to deconstruct that it would be really great if somebody could really tell stories.
So what are you seeing when you go in there?
I mean, just, it's your classic small town. Here's the people who live here. What motivates them? What makes them afraid? What are their hopes and dreams? All these kind of things that, you know, I think a lot of people were attracted to, say, Trump because they felt completely overlooked by the establishment. And so, like, what? We're getting a little too deep here, but I'm just interested in, like, what drives all the contradictions that are the, or that is the South.
Yeah, 100%.
Which is the basis of, like, all the art that's been made here for the last 200 years, but a podcast that was specific would be pretty interesting.
I would be really interested in it. And if I had a little bit more time on my hands, I might either try to get that off the ground myself, but I don't have a lot of time.
I feel like the Trillbillies are a great example of that. You listen to them much, and then it's a different region, but it's a Southern thing. And they're very funny, too, so that helps, but... Yeah, it's just an underrepresented place.
If we could ever rope Lee Baines and Caleb Johnson into doing a podcast for us, they would pick up the mantle of that.
Yeah.
I thought they were going to do a food podcast.
Except they would just argue with each other.
Which would be great,
like
too.
Children. Yeah, it would be great. Have either of you been keeping up with the new Apple TV Plus show, Severance, with Adam Scott and John Turturro?
I haven't yet.
Not yet.
It's got such an interesting premise, and it's getting really rave reviews. I may try to promise our listeners that we're going to cover that. We're off next week, but maybe we might could get around to it. It's directed by Ben Stiller. I think every episode is directed by Ben Stiller. And it's raising my eyebrow a lot every time I see a little headline for it. So I'm definitely going to watch it. We'll talk about it on air, maybe.
What was the last thing Ben Stiller directed?
It was that Showtime... He directed all 7-8 episodes of the Showtime Escape from Prison drama, Escape from Dannemora, I think the name
did
of it.
Did he?
Fascinating. Just so good. In fact, if you had a bunch of time on your hands, like listeners, if you had a bunch of time, I know we're just overwhelmed with television options, but that's worth going back and watching. It's good.
Interesting.
Last week, we brought up some new music. Particularly the Big Thief record, which is a very unique title, Dragon Warm Mountain, I Believe in You. I think that's right. I don't know. It's just
sure.
Something. It's the new one. We wanted to give it a proper listen, as it does have some length to it, being a double album. Also, here's the thing. I'm on a rant today. I'm feeling rantish. You guys, before we even started podcasting, I was ranting. You know, it's okay to talk about an album, movie, or show past its release date. That's one of the things about this podcast that we hopefully do. That's the audience we may draw, is we don't believe in necessarily release dates, not all the time. Shows sometimes, yes, movies sometimes, yes, but it's okay. You know, just because a show is released on Tuesday doesn't mean the conversation ends on Wednesday, which is what Twitter would have you believe. There's no expiration date for reviews and discussions. So this Big Thief Brooklyn band, to no one's surprise. But I love them.
Are they still a Brooklyn band?
I think they still claim that, right?
I don't know. I mean, I think they're just like an American band at this point.
They should be.
Met in Brooklyn for sure.
Let's get into that.
I'm gonna see what Google says about Big Thief.
So they'll say a Brooklyn band, right?
You're totally. That was the first few records that was their band from Brooklyn. I just don't know what they would describe themselves as anymore.
The blurb. Is based in Brooklyn.
Uh-huh. What do you think, Williamsburg? Is that right, Adam?
No, I bet it was somewhere else. I doubt Williamsburg would have been prohibitively expensive for them. I would
Yeah. anyway, yeah. So that is part of their, I don't know, appeal, but that, you know, Brooklyn band, you get, there is certain attachments that come with that label, and they announced this album a while back. It started getting just a little bit of hype rolling. I wouldn't be surprised to see them like on the cover of like a Rolling Stone or something. It's very, very soon about this particular album. And Adam, you said last week you were enjoying it, but then you let us know this week you thought it was a masterpiece. You let us know in like a text message. And that's a fitting word if you know the band. Why a masterpiece?
I've loved this band. I listened to the first record when it came out. There was a Saddle Creek thing, which I think is another interesting wrinkle in their story of who is this band, identity, all these things, because they were in Brooklyn but put the record out with a label that's very Midwestern or very Nebraskan, and then started touring and just did it the old-fashioned way of, I mean, like I saw them on those early days of just like living out of a van and doing it, and to see them go.
You saw them live?
Yeah, I did. It was amazing.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, I saw them a few times in those days. I saw them at, they had a really, you know those bands that hit South by Southwest, like with a little bit of juice going in, and then over the course of a week, they're like all you can read about. Like Courtney Barnett in 2014-ish had one of these
South
bys.
Yeah, good example.
Yeah. Fleet Foxes had one years before that. The list is long, but they had one. Maybe 2016, 15, somewhere in that range. And they came, like, they've done NPR showcases, they've done all these kind of bigger events, and then we're going to tour through Birmingham and play the Syndicate Lounge, which was the place downtown, upstairs, I don't remember what was downstairs, but it was not the most glamorous place to play. Oh, I mean, I had fun going to shows there and playing shows there, but it's a long way from Saturn, I'll say that. And this was post Bottle Tree, and they were playing on a Tuesday night, and I like begged everybody I knew in Birmingham. It's like, y'all have to come see this show. And everybody was kind of lukewarm on it. And so I went by myself and watched them with like 15 or 20 other people. My buddy.
No.
Oh yeah. And they were great. I mean, they just played an incredible set. It was very, we ended up bumping into them down the road at some festivals when they had maybe gone up another notch, and I got to see some of the inner workings of the band a little bit just through being around backstage. Some of the most genuine, like that collective energy that they have, I have never seen another band have that level of, like what they present as like, we're all together, you know, we love each other, we respect all these things, like that's all real. This is a very rare. It's very rare.
Which is interesting because the lead singer, Adrian Lenker? I don't want to mispronounce her name, but yeah, listeners know I'm horrible with names. But anyway, Adrian, she released like a solo album or two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not that long ago.
As did the guitar player.
Okay. So that obviously wasn't I need to go out and do my own thing because of this band.
I think
that's good to know.
They're just,
I was unsure.
Yeah. They're a very prolific group of people. Like I think out of all
that's cool.
Bands that I have been around, and again, I hung out with them, name drop. Like we like rode a bus to a festival together and we're around in the backstage area. So you just see how like interpersonal relationships
really cool,
work in that setting. And it's not like, I think there are those people who as artists to me are like genuinely out there. Like the old idea of the artist being like kind of on the edge of society and like bringing things back from whatever they're communing with the universe, if you want to get like mystical about it, which they are kind of a very like cosmic
band. They have that look.
Band. Yeah, that stuff's for real. Like I think they're one of the few people channeling something out there and bringing it back. And what I love about this one, this is a long way to say why I think it's a masterpiece, I think everything was they had done before was either that level of inspired or very, very good. Like there wasn't a lot of fluff to me. And they had moments of being really, really phenomenal. But it was always really serious. You know what I mean? Like, the songs were pretty heavy, which is fine, but I think this one just is, I mean, it sounds like a weird American record. It's playful at times. Mm-hmm. It plays with genre. It plays mm-hmm. with production. It does all of this stuff. The lyrically, it's playful. I mean, there's on that Spud Infinity song, which has somehow become my favorite, despite its goofiness. You know, she talks about, like, not being able to lick her elbows, like that old joke of, like, you can't lick your elbows. And then goes on, like, three lines later, turns it into, like, this profound point about what all are they rubbing up against, mm-hmm. which are really just, it's just like, how do you do that? How are you so clever that you can turn the benign into art? And when people can do that and
yeah.
make me believe that they had fun doing it, that's really special.
That must be where some of the just expansiveness of the album comes from. Because they do sound like they're having fun. And if they really are channeling something, especially on this one, they do have that sense of channeling something from the edges. I think this is the first album of theirs that I've really liked every song all the way through, too.
Yeah. In fact, that kind of let me down a little. During the pandemic, I decided I'm going to be the guy who buys vinyl. I made that decision. That was the time for it, and I went all in. And, some of our listeners might be able to relate to this. When you decide to become the person who buys vinyl records, you start to think, I can't own everything I want to own. What goes on the shelf and what stays in the store? And Big Thief made the cut, and I went ahead and bought all of their records at the time. And I was a little disappointed back in 2019. They released two albums within 5 months of each other. Mm-hmm. It was UFOF and Two Hands, and I just felt like that could have been one album.
I agree
if they would have just been patient. Mm-hmm. And it would have been a really good one album. And so I was a little disappointed because I listened to them back to back, kind of, and I was just like, oh man, I don't know. So, and this is their next release after that. And coming off of those two albums and having a little sadness that maybe they weren't as good as I thought, I'm happy about this record. It is exactly, I guess Adam said it the best, so I don't want to be too redundant, but there's a certain seriousness still going on, but it's not quite a downer seriousness.
More weirdo seriousness.
Uh-huh.
I think my favorite song on it right now is Sparrow, and it, which is sort of, I guess you could say it's serious. You know, it's talking about Adam and Eve and the book of Genesis and stuff like that, but it's weird more than anything else. It's not like a downer song.
Is that the one where right. she says apple like four lines yeah. in a row and you're like, why do you
she
keep
says
saying
apple
it?
A thousand times.
Yeah, and it's irritating until it becomes artful.
Uh-huh.
It gets in your head.
Yeah.
And it's got that great bit with like she talks to snakes and they guide her.
Yeah.
There's a lot of good lines. Adam, you picked up the one on Spud Infinity. There's a lot of good lines in this one. I really love how the first and the last song kind of come full circle with the first one starting with "Would you live forever, never die," mm-hmm. and then the last one "Would you live forever till you die." And that last song has such a fun playfulness to it. I want to be the wrinkle in your eye. I want to be the shoelace that you tie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and going from and the first one is much more serious, and the record kind of spans the, like Adam said, the record kind of spans the gulf between those two really well.
I like the song Little Things. Like, I think it's the seventh song in there. Mm-hmm. I mean, just pick a song on this album. It's going to be really good, if not
pretty good.
There is even like, and this might be the Spud Infinity song where it kind of starts out like, oh, this is going to be a little off kilter, a little goofy, and I might not like it, but okay, I'll definitely sit through it because I want to hear it. But it turns into just really, is this the Spud Infinity where it turns into just a really good song, even though it starts a little quirky? It
starts out with the jaw harp.
I like that, yes.
Yeah.
I do like a jaw harp. I don't mind it one bit. And there's a little bit of cliche in that, a Brooklyn band doing a jaw harp kind of thing, but it's not what you think. It's not It's not Mumford and Sons kind of jaw harp, right?
No, it's this like rambly, weirdo folk rock.
Yeah, this is back to my point about like, are they really a Brooklyn band or an American band at this point? Because
exactly,
they met there and then toured so much that you quickly realize, you know, she spent all this time in Minnesota. She's written about it. She has that kind of like, you know, northern... I mean, like a song like Mythological Beauty, name check some of that. And I think that's probably was their best single song up until now. I'm going to have to rethink that in light of the new record. But you have that energy from her.
Masterpiece.
And then you have Masterpiece is really great, too. I don't know. Mythological Beauty was just next level. And it did that thing that I think, like Little Things does it, too. They had this ability to do things that are... like circular and rhythm is the best way that I can describe it, but they groove really hard. Like the drums kind of, nothing's really overplaying at all, but you're like, you still kind of want to move. You know what I mean? And it's an interesting trick when you're using, you know, you guys are talking about more traditional instruments, but you know, like the, even the fiddle stuff on this, I think maybe it feels a little bit more earned because like Buck Meek, the guitar player, has put out these solo records, and we know that he's a Texas guy who like grew up in that world, kind of absorbed in that world of Texas folk and country and all this stuff. I don't know. It feels more, you know, they're not a bunch of like college graduate, Ivy League, whatever, who ended up in Brooklyn and decided to start a band. Like they were genuine before they met, and then they earned their stripes afterward. So, I mean, they're... I don't, you know, be bringing up the instrumentation. There's so many bands that do that that I'm so sick of. Like, I'm so sick of Americana, you know, air quotes around the Americana genre and that whole thing. And here they put out a folk rock record that is blowing my mind.
There's dashes of Bonnie Prince. Bonnie Prince Billy a little, but Bonnie Light Horseman. I hear dashes of that.
Yeah,
and it was so good. They do it well, yeah.
Yeah, maybe just from Bonnie Light Horseman directly, you know, not even tipping their cap, but just playing old folk standards and doing it so well. I mean, I'm sure there's some cross-pollination. The world is not a big place in the world of indie rock, so I'm sure they're aware.
You know, their first two albums, Big Thief's first two albums, they used, like, family... They look like family photos from 1986. And just, I've never known a band that encapsulated exactly what they would sound like with a photo. I've known bands to do it with artwork, a painting or something on the album cover. But this, and I looked at those album covers, and Adam, you were the first person I knew that had them on vinyl, and I pulled it off the shelf, and I remember looking at it and thinking, Christ almighty, this is going to be way too heartfelt.
Yeah.
Like, just looking at this picture alone hurts my heart. It's like I'm diving into somebody's photo album I wasn't supposed to see. Both of those pictures look like that. So, I mean, it's amazing to me how a photograph alone that you do not know can almost make you cry. And then that's exactly what kind of music they made on those first two albums a lot of times. And I'm glad they've grown, not that I'm glad they've grown away from that, but I'm glad that this album isn't that. And I'm with you guys. It's fantastic. It's easily their best album, to me.
Yeah. And I was with you a little bit.
I'd agree.
Had a little trepidation about the last two records and the fact that they were putting out solo work, and it's like, they're so good. They can be so good. Why not get somebody to say, just pick the 10 best songs. Give me 40 of your best minutes from the last few years. And then, of course, they totally blow what I think they should do out of the water with a double record that is just top to bottom great. I was anxious. I didn't rush into listening to this, I will say, because I like them so much. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if they had, you know, bands that burn that bright can burn out. Poets who are so good in their late 20s may never reach those heights again, that kind of idea. And I wondered if the lightning was not there, but I was clearly super wrong and gladly glad to be.
Adam, you hear any studio tricks on this album that you're frustrated in a good way, that you think to yourself, why didn't I do that?
The production, I sent it immediately to the guys in Speckled Bird. And, you know, we living in a studio town, we can get really hyper-focused on, like the War on Drugs records are just borderline pornographic if you love studio stuff. You know, because it's so pristine and perfect and labored over, and I love them. And it's, you know, you can have, there's a lot of ways to get the job done, but this one is not even remotely uniform in its production. Like, I don't think you have to know anything about a studio to hear, like, oh, on track whatever, you can hear the tape screaming, like hissing, before they start playing. You can hear chatter afterward. It doesn't always, like, the guitars don't sound good sometimes. Like, you can hear the channel peaking, and, like, it just doesn't matter. Because if they got the magic on that one, then who cares? Or they may have done it intentionally. They do such a good marriage of, like, at times lo-fi with, one, undeniably great songs. So it doesn't... I mean, I'm of the belief that if the song is great enough, it doesn't matter what the facade is, what the studio wrapping is. As far as tricks, I mean, we talked a little bit last week about they went to four different studios. That was the idea. That was the plan to go. The drummer produced the record, and he told the band, if you've read any of the press, I'm going to be redundant here, but he told the band that he thinks they should go to these four different studios in four different parts of the country and make a record and just try to channel what's ever there. And so, like, they worked with this guy on a few tracks named Sean Everett, who does the War on Drugs stuff. But he's only on three of however many tracks. Like, the total dependence on that idea and not really caring about, like, what they quote-unquote should do. And then they could get any, like, bigwig indie producer that they wanted, and I think they just went for it on like kind of eschewing doing it that way. As far as direct studio tricks, I feel like they use a high-strung acoustic guitar, a Nashville guitar, Nashville tuning, they often call it. You ever play one of those, Blaine?
Never have.
Instead of having your top four strings being a heavier gauge, they're all like the E and the B string are. So if you play that with a six string, it sounds a bit like a 12 string when the two guitars are working together. Or you can just play it by itself, and it has kind of a... Because once you're like making the record, you're kind of thinking more in terms of like the sonic landscape, right? Instead of like, I need a guitar here, you think I need a certain range of frequencies here. So some of like playing that like Nashville guitar lets some of those parts poke through in a really nice way, and kind of gives it that light, airy quality that some of these that move super well, what I was talking about with that like very grooving, but they're not heavy footed about it. All these little choices kind of add up to make that, I think.
That's so interesting to me. Lynn Bridges, great engineer.
Yeah.
Said once, and dead serious, he said, I don't care if it's recorded on a watch. If the performance is good, you keep it. There you go, Big Thief. We're raving about it. We probably could say more. Let's take our break, and on the other side, we'll talk about Euphoria. If you're new to us, subscribe, rate, review, or share us online. We would appreciate that. If you're not new to us, just thanks for returning. Let us know how you've been. We want to hear from you, and you can reach out to us on any social media site where we're found. We house this podcast under just the Alabama Take, no other social media to find. But we're on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, and YouTube. Don't forget that on thealabamatake.com, you can get to our Tee Public store. You can buy t-shirts, stickers, mugs, and more for any of our shows and logos, such as This Song Sucks, or just an Alabama Take piece unto itself. This Song Sucks. We'll be recording its third season before too long and releasing that. They have their own social media too that they kind of use because it makes sense if you go follow them. Or maybe it doesn't. That's Hayden and Josh. We love those guys. So there you go. Go find that. They're hard to love, but, you know. Let's get back into taking it down this week. Yeah, so the sixth episode of Euphoria.
Is that Greek?
Mm-hmm.
Euphoria?
Yeah, Euphoria. It's about teenage skin conditions. Euphoria. Oh, me. I hated teenage years because of my skin. Jesus. That's so unfair. This one, sixth episode, we're talking about A Thousand Little Trees of Blood. Adam, have you noticed they have such interesting titles?
Like,
really out there kind of titles?
They're all pretty pretty literary or pretty film aware, right?
I think so. I haven't done a deep dive on just the title, but it would be worth it. This one took the focus solely off Rue, now that she's safe at home and seeing some daylight from her withdrawals with the help of Ali's cooking. That's kind of where she's left. Yeah, so after that Odyssey episode of Rue escaping death and cops, playwright Jeremy Harris tweeted that this show isn't this generation's Kids, if you're familiar with that movie, but this generation's Pulp Fiction.
Interesting.
I don't know about that. That's an interesting tweet, and I appreciate the thought put into it, but I didn't like Kids. I didn't like that movie.
Mm.
I think because it was kind of scary to me, honestly. I was the age of those kids when it was being shown, and it freaked me out.
Euphoria would freak me out if I was the age that they are.
I think so. But you know what? I swear every day a new teenager comes up to me and says, I heard you watch Euphoria. Did you watch this week's episode? So teenagers love this show. Love it. And you know, kudos. It's a good one to love. So I thought this episode six was really good. That's not unusual, but it felt like a little bit of a letdown after that fifth Odyssey episode, as I keep calling it. Were you, I wouldn't say bored, sort of distanced from this one more so? That, or was it the result of an episode that focused so much on Nate Jacobs?
Who is the worst?
I mean, for real.
Yeah, this was his Odyssey episode in some way.
A little bit.
I don't know that I would say that I was bored with it.
No, I wouldn't either.
A letdown coming off of such a great episode where the stakes were super high, which, I mean, I guess when a gun is involved, the stakes were raised again this week, but...
They did it again, yeah.
Yeah, the episode with Rue is like one of the best things that I've ever seen on TV, you know, in a single episode. I just thought it was so well done. And of course, there's going to be a letdown. There has to be. The next week.
Maybe not let down, but come down.
Come down, for sure. And I wondered about that. You know, like when she stumbles into the Cassie-Maddie debate, when that she kind of kicks the hornet's nest and then runs while everybody's getting chased by the hornets, which was very funny. And I mean, it's sad what's happening, but it was also very funny. But you even then, you think, the stakes are so high for... Rue, and Zendaya is so good. Not that everybody else involved isn't, but, you know, you see a little glimpse, and I remember thinking during that episode, like, oh, we're going to have to circle back to this, to, like, high school boyfriend drama eventually, and it's going to be such a letdown, a come down.
No one would accept Rue right now where she is in the episodes, except for Ollie. So, I'm interested in how she even starts to patch up or interact with other characters going forward. She'll have to go back to school. I'm also of a mind that these episodes are a little bit better when they have some stuff happening in school, at least one or two scenes in school. It sort of needs that grounding, lest the drama gets a little unbelievable.
Yeah.
You know, it's so, you talked about it being high level drama. It kind of needs a scene or two in their high school stuff.
Yeah, especially because they're functioning more like college kids than high school kids. I mean, like with the amount of freedom that they have. And I mean, you get a certain amount of that in high school, but I think, I don't know, they're basically just all on their own, except for, and you see a few moms here and there, but yeah, I mean, I thought the Rue was in the episode, you know, I guess we shouldn't totally gloss over the scenes at home with Ollie coming to cook for the family. Like, I thought his interaction with Rue's sister was pretty powerful, pretty strong. The investigation of what it means to love somebody going through that, you know, how do you feel your own feelings, all of that was a great follow-up to last week.
Did you watch the in-between episodes, these sort of in between season to the two episodes of?
No, we were so desperate to catch up with what was happening. We're saving those for, you're talking about Rue and Jules, right?
Right. Coleman Domingo, who plays Ali, fantastic actor. But Coleman Domingo was quoted somewhere recently saying how much time he prepares for a role, and he talked about how many hours he spent in preparation for one of those in-between episodes, because he's featured in one a little bit. I wasn't comfortable with Nate's conversation with his mom. When were you?
No.
That was an uncomfortable.
I thought he was going to hurt her.
Yeah, and I thought she was kind of, yeah, exactly. She was in trouble, I thought. And he's so deep in his own lies, it seems like. Is that what we were supposed to take away from that scene? That he can't do anything but deny what his mom's observed, and I feel like what we have observed about him?
I think they did a fine job with her being this woman who's going through something insane, right, and trying to cope. And he's there, and she's kind of, like, her talking about him as a kid and trying to figure out kind of like a nature versus nurture debate on what caused him to turn out. They keep playing with that a little bit. Like, you know, Rue, to go back an episode, imagines her dad holding her and saying, "You're not a bad person," which was so crushing. And then her mom telling her, "Rue, you're not a good person." And then to go forward an episode and to yet again have a parental figure kind of morally judge a kid. There's strong echoes there from, you know, she's saying, "I don't know whose fault it is. Was it your dad's fault? Was it my fault? Were you just going to be this way?" Do you think he believes the lie, or do you think he's just totally committed to it?
He's hard to read, and he's playing it in a way that is supposed to be hard to read, that you can't figure out if he's really like that, or that cold, or robotic, or if he just has to put that on in order to feel like, in order to go forward.
But then at the end of the episode, when he interacts with Jules, he is fully aware and in control of his the true understanding of that web of the situation that he created there.
Yeah, so that's got to be a sign that he knows that he's putting on a show, right?
Yeah.
Speaking of Nate, I really want to see his dad, Cal, again, because, and I imagine we will, but that development has turned into something that maybe even people could relate to, and I did not see that coming.
I thought I figured he was going to be a very hateable guy, start to finish.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you mentioned Nate when he was being, quote, Tyler to Jules, when he was texting her as this Tyler person. So was he lying to Jules when he said all that was real? Is that just another part of his manipulation?
That's what's so great about the show, is it makes you, we've talked a few times about how they will not talk about an event or like an important fact, an inciting incident, whatever, and you kind of have to just put the pieces together based on the ripple effect, you know, and then maybe later they confirm what you thought. I think that I assumed that it was real, and then he got upset when he put everything together. I don't think he was just out to get her, you know. I think he actually, maybe he was confused by his own feelings of being into a trans person. There was some transphobia going on. I don't know. I don't know what the background is. Because like you said, he is playing it so cold.
I'd be interested to see this actor in something else. Or an interview with the guy who plays Nate. Hey, I bet he smiles and cuts up and whatever.
I kind of wonder if he's going to get the Draco Malfoy treatment after this is over. You know, like, how do you move on from being this incredibly punchable human being to, like, having a career? I don't know.
Yeah, his next role should totally be fun-loving hero. Talking about a come-down, though, something about Lexi and Fesco's pairing this episode, I'm totally for him. It just seemed less believable. I didn't have the buy-in. I did not buy that she was at a comfort level with him to be at his house and just hanging out on his couch.
Same.
So the setting just, like, they should have had that happen, some of that happen in, like, the store or something that he runs.
Yeah, I mean, he's a drug dealer. Why would he let, you know, they have, like, eyes all over the property. You got, I mean, someone's been killed in that room. Why would he let her come over, and why would she go over there? Because she seems more out of all of them, she seems the most like well-adjusted, right? And like kind of aware of what's happening.
If Fez is destined for jail.
You think a bust is coming? Something?
Yeah. Sad. I do. And lots of camera stuff. Maddie even has a poster on her wall, or a sign on her wall that says, "Smile, you're on camera." And then she's probably being watched on camera at the home where she babysits.
Well, and Rue also laid out how she could recruit people to sell drugs for her, right? That they have all of this stuff that she could blackmail them with. So that idea of blackmail has been thrown into the mix for sure.
Lots of camera stuff. You're always on camera. You're always being watched, even from season one. This show does big endings, but wow, what a wonderfully quiet shot of Rue and Gia sleeping together as sisters while their mom tries to get Rue in rehab. And it just as devastating and emotionally relevant as any of the other endings. And it puts it back in that reality, I think, that maybe the episode was missing just a touch of. Whew, that was sad.
That was tough. That was really tough to hear her pleading.
The show continues to be great. We'll play a little catch-up with that next time we're on. It'll be 2 weeks. Might talk Severance. It's quite possible. Might talk The Girl Before on HBO Max. We did not get around to that today, but we'll see. That'll be it for this week, so we're off next week. Send us your thoughts, check in with us on social media, and we'll give you a heads up on what we'll be talking about in the next episode. We'll talk to everybody later on.